There is this feeling that I think we all get sometimes. It's sort of like being caught in a psychological rip current, right? You're swimming as hard as you can, the panic is setting in, and despite all your frantic effort, you're just, being pulled further and further out to sea.
Yeah, that is exactly what it feels like.
Right. And in that moment, what you really need isn't to swim harder. You need an anchor. So in this deep dive, we're pulling a highly practical toolkit from the Raft program to help you forge exactly that kind of anchor. We're going to look at how you can find genuine stability in a world that often feels, well, incredibly overwhelming, especially if you ever find yourself caught in loops of stress or these deep patterns of escape and self-sabotage.
I really love that rip current metaphor because when the water gets rough, trying to just outthink the ocean never works.
No, definitely not.
We spend so much of our lives caught in those powerful psychological currents, desperately trying to intellectualize our way out of overwhelming urges. To stop being carried away, we actually have to look at the core framework of the Raft program.
Right, and RAFT is an acronym, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So RAFT stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, and Train. And it basically functions as this sequential mechanical process for moving from a state of, well, constant mental bondage to a place of genuine freedom.
Okay, so if the goal here is to forge an anchor so we can actually utilize this RAFT framework, I imagine we first need to understand the vessel we're tying that anchor to.
Exactly.
How does this anchor fit into the larger structure of the raft itself?
Well, the construction of this vessel begins with the first letter of the acronym, which is recognize. And what we're recognizing is a fundamental reality about human existence.
Which is what exactly?
So this traces back to a core realization by Gautama, the Buddha. He recognized that conditioned existence, basically the everyday reality of being human, is inherently difficult, painful, and disappointing.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the traditional word for this is dukkha. So we are starting on what the Raft program calls the dangerous shore.
So it's really about radical honesty then. It's looking at the rip current and saying, yes, this water is actually dangerous, instead of pretending you're like floating in a heated pool.
Yeah, precisely. You have to acknowledge the reality first.
Right. So once you admit the water is treacherous, what actually makes up the physical structure of this raft we're building?
The structural planks are built from our ethical commitments, which the program calls the five gifts. These essentially revolve around a really deep commitment to harmlessness.
Okay, harmlessness.
Right. But, planks alone, just floating on the water, they'll inevitably drift apart under the pressure of a storm. They have to be lashed together securely.
Right, you need something holding it all together.
Exactly. And the rope that binds this raft together, giving it resilience and structural integrity, is self-compassion.
Self-compassion. Okay, that's interesting. The program actually points to the work of researcher Kristen Neff to explain this. When we're hurting, our default instinct is usually to isolate and criticize
Oh,
ourselves.
absolutely.
But Neff suggests offering ourselves a very simple phrase in moments of distress, which is just, this is a moment of suffering. You meet your own pain with the exact same kindness you would offer a good friend.
Wait, let me stop you there because that feels completely counterintuitive to how most of us operate. I mean, when we are caught in those patterns of escape and self-sabotage, our immediate reaction to our own mistakes is almost never compassion.
Right, it's usually the opposite.
Yeah, it's harsh self-judgment. It's this angry inner monologue saying, why did you do that again? What is wrong with you? We just assume that beating ourselves up is the only way to maintain discipline.
I hear that a lot, but that harsh internal environment is exactly where the human struggle with craving thrives. Just think about the mechanics of it. When you respond to your own pain or a mistake with aversion or shame or anger, you are instantly adding a massive secondary layer of suffering on top of the original problem.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I can see that.
Shame is incredibly isolating. It physically elevates your stress hormones, and it ends up fueling those exact compulsive and reactive behaviors because your brain desperately wants to escape the fresh shame you just manufactured.
So responding to our own slip-ups with shame is basically like trying to fix a leak in a boat by drilling more holes.
That is the perfect analogy.
You think you're fixing the problem, but you're really just taking on more water and actively sinking the ship.
That is the exact mechanism. Compassion isn't just like a warm, fuzzy feeling or a way to let yourself off the hook. It is the structural integrity of the raft.
Right, it holds the planks together.
Yes, it allows you to acknowledge the reality of pain, to say, yes, this hurts, this urge is really difficult, without adding resistance or judgment. You stop viewing your struggles as a moral failure and start viewing them simply as suffering that requires care.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so we have a sturdy raft. We have our planks of harmlessness securely lashed together with the strong rope of self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But a sturdy raft without an anchor is still completely at the mercy of the currents. You'll just float wherever the tide takes you. Right?
Exactly. You need to drop anchor.
And the program says the first anchor we need to drop is mindfulness of the body. But why the body? Like, why not mindfulness of our thoughts or our emotions?
Well, Gautama laid out a very specific logic for this. If you observe your own mind for even 60 seconds, you'll immediately notice its defining characteristic. It's a compulsive time traveler.
A time traveler. Okay. Yeah, that tracks.
Right. It is constantly obsessing over past regrets, you know, analyzing conversations from 3 years ago, or it's spiraling into anxieties about a future that hasn't even happened yet. The mind is rarely grounded in the present.
Yeah, it's always anywhere but here.
Exactly. But the body, the physical form, only ever exists in the present moment. It physically cannot time travel. It is the immediate material of our vessel, always touching the water of current experience.
That's fascinating, because we spend so much time living entirely from the neck up, especially today.
Oh, completely.
We basically treat our bodies like they're just organic Ubers designed to carry our brains from one meeting to the next, or, you know, from one screen to another.
That is so true.
Let's make this highly practical for you listening right now. If my boss sends me an incredibly stressful email, and my immediate instinct is to spiral into panic and reach for my favorite pattern of escape, how does shifting my attention downward into my body actually interrupt that? Like, how does feeling my feet on the floor stop a panic attack?
To understand the mechanics of that, we really have to look at a concept called conditioned existence.
Okay, conditioned existence.
Right. This is the fundamental truth that everything, our thoughts, our cravings, our bodily sensations, none of it exists independently. Everything arises strictly because of causes and conditions, and everything is constantly changing.
So it's not permanent.
Exactly. When you live purely in your head, the stress from that email feels like a permanent, undeniable, monolithic command. It feels entirely solid.
Yeah, it feels like it's taking over everything.
But when you observe that stress in the physical body, you start to see its true fragmented nature. And to help us see this clearly, the RAFT program breaks it down 6 specific lenses of body mindfulness.
6 lenses. No.
Yes. These are 6 different angles to view this physical vessel, showing us exactly how to dismantle that solid wall of panic.
So if conditioned existence means everything is constantly changing, how do we actually use these 6 lenses to see that happening in our own bodies without just getting, I don't know, more overwhelmed?
Well, the first lens is the most immediate. It's breathing. And this isn't about forcing the breath to change. It's simply observing it, coming in and going out, noticing if it's short or long, smooth or rough.
Okay, just noticing it.
Right. When that stressful email arrives, your breath automatically becomes shallow and rapid, which signals your brain that you are in physical danger. By simply anchoring your attention on the breath, you create this microscopic gap between the stimulus, the email, and your habitual reaction.
Oh, I see. You step out of the mental story and into the physical reality.
Exactly. You're interrupting the biofeedback loop.
That's really powerful. Okay, what's the second lens?
Posture. Literally just noticing, am I walking, standing, sitting, or lying down? It sounds almost insultingly simple, but think about what happens to your posture when you're anxious.
Yeah.
Your shoulders creep up toward your ears, your chest caves in, your jaw clenches.
I'm literally adjusting my shoulders as you say that because I didn't even realize I was tensing up.
See? Exactly.
But does just noticing that I'm slouching or tensing actually stop a psychological spiral?
It really does, because your brain takes cues from your muscles. If your body is locked in a defensive, hunched posture, your brain assumes there is a predator in the room.
Wow, so it keeps you stressed.
Yes, it keeps you in a state of high alert. By bringing awareness to your posture and consciously allowing it to shift, you are sending a physiological signal back to the brain that it is safe to stand down.
That makes so much sense.
Which leads directly to the third lens, which is clear comprehension in daily actions. This is about bringing full awareness to mundane movements like eating, getting dressed, reaching for a door handle.
Wait, clear comprehension in daily actions. Does that just mean paying intense attention while I'm brushing my teeth or like opening a fridge?
Basically, yeah.
How does that stop me from engaging in a pattern of self-sabotage later in the day?
Because self-sabotage almost exclusively lives in the realm of autopilot. Think about how often you find yourself halfway through a bag of chips or 30 minutes deep into scrolling on your phone without making a conscious decision to start.
Oh, constantly.
Right. You didn't choose it. You just drifted into it. Clear comprehension is about breaking that trance of mindless momentum.
Okay, I get that.
If you can train yourself to be fully present while opening a door, you are building the exact neurological muscle required to stay present when an overwhelming urge tries to hijack your hands.
Okay, those first three lenses, breathing, posture, daily actions, they make total sense to me.
Yeah.
They're very grounding. But here's where I'm going to push back a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
Because the next three lenses get a bit intense. The fourth lens is the reality of the body, which involves contemplating our anatomy, like visualizing the body as a collection of internal parts like bones and organs.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth is viewing the body through the serenities. Elements, solidity, fluidity, heat, movement. And the sixth is impermanence, actively reflecting on the body's aging, decay, and inevitable mortality.
Yeah, I completely understand why those sound jarring.
It sounds a bit morbid, doesn't it? I mean, I get noticing my breath. But reflecting on my anatomy as a collection of parts or fixating on my own decay, how does focusing on my own mortality lead to freedom? For most people, wouldn't that just trigger a massive existential crisis?
It is a very common reaction to feel resistant to those lenses, for sure. But we have to look at what this specific practice is designed to mechanically dismantle.
Which is?
It is dismantling the deepest delusion we carry, the delusion of a permanent, controllable self. We walk around carrying this heavy, exhausting burden of me and mine.
Oh, that makes sense.
We view our bodies as this solid, unchanging identity that we have to protect, perfect, and satisfy at all costs. We mistakenly believe the body can be a reliable source of lasting, permanent pleasure.
And when it inevitably isn't, we suffer.
Precisely. That delusion is the engine that drives patterns of escape and self-sabotage. We grasp at temporary pleasures, trying to find permanent satisfaction in a vessel that is fundamentally impermanent. So let's run a thought experiment. Imagine an intense craving hits you. If you view yourself as a solid, permanent I, the craving feels like, I need this. I'm consumed by this. It feels monolithic. But if you drop into the fourth and fifth lenses, breaking the body down into parts and elements, what happens?
Well, I guess you stop saying, I am on fire with craving, and you start saying, there is just heat in my chest.
Exactly that. You notice tightness in the jaw, which is solidity. You notice a flush in the face, which is heat. You notice a restless energy in the arms, movement.
Wow.
Suddenly, the monolithic, terrifying I disappears. The craving isn't a dictator commanding you anymore. It's just a temporary collection of physical sensations. Heat, pressure, movement arising and passing away.
That is a completely different way to experience it.
Right. When you deeply realize that this body isn't a permanent, solid self that you have to constantly defend and indulge, the heavy burden of me gets infinitely lighter. It doesn't cause an existential crisis. It relieves the immense pressure you've been putting on yourself to fight reality.
That makes a lot of sense. You are deconstructing the illusion so the craving loses its absolute authority over you. And what is so fascinating about this is that while we are talking about 2,500-year-old insights from Gautama, modern science is now proving exactly why this physical anchoring works.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not just ancient philosophy, right? It is hard neurology.
Yeah.
But what exactly is happening in our nervous system when we do this?
Well, modern neuroscience relies on a term called interoception. This is basically your brain's ability to perceive, interpret, and integrate the internal state of your physical body.
Interoception.
Yeah. We have a region in the brain called the insula, which acts sort of like a radar dish. It is constantly taking in bodily signals, your heart rate, the rhythm of your digestion, subtle muscle tension, and it uses that data to regulate your emotions and drive your decision making.
But what happens to this physical connection when someone is trapped in a cycle of chronic stress? Or when they're deeply entrenched in patterns of escape, do those signals just get louder?
Actually, no, the opposite usually happens. When the signals of stress or trauma become too overwhelming, the brain's defense mechanism is to literally mute the channel.
Really? Just shuts it down?
Yeah, the interoceptive pathways become severely disrupted. The person becomes disconnected from their own physical signals. They feel a vague, overwhelming sense of panic or a sudden, uncontrollable urge, but they have no idea what their body is actually feeling.
So the brain and body just stop communicating.
Exactly. They stop communicating properly, which leaves the person totally at the mercy of their impulses.
So if we are disconnected, how does dropping this anchor using those six lenses to pay attention to the body actually rebuild that connection.
By deliberately practicing mindfulness of the body, you are actively exercising and strengthening those interoceptive pathways in the insula. And the biological results are measurable too.
Really? Like you can see it on a chart?
Yes. Science shows that cultivating body awareness actually engages the vagus nerve. Think of the vagus nerve as the body's internal brake pedal.
Okay, the brake pedal.
Right. When it's strong and responsive, a state we call having high vagal tone, it can quickly pump the brakes on your nervous system's fight or flight response. Dropping the anchor of body mindfulness actively improves vagal tone and increases heart rate variability, which are the primary biological markers of emotional regulation.
Wait, so when you're focusing on your breath or noticing the heat in your chest during a craving, you aren't just relaxing or trying to distract yourself. You're fundamentally rewiring your biological hardware.
Yes. It is worse than useless to try and just think your way out of a severe nervous system response. Our compulsive behaviors are deeply physically tied to our fight, flight, or freeze mechanisms.
Yeah, you can't logic your way out of a physiological response.
Exactly. When an urge to self-sabotage hits, it doesn't just happen as a polite suggestion in your thoughts. It happens as a tightening in the throat, a profound restlessness in the limbs, a feeling of absolute panic in the gut. If you are entirely disconnected from your body, that physical urge hits you like an overwhelming tidal wave.
But if you have built your raft, if it's bound together with a rope of self-compassion, and your anchor of body mindfulness is securely set, you can meet that physical urge entirely differently.
Exactly.
You don't have to treat the tension in your chest as an enemy you have to go to war with, or like a fire you have to immediately put out.
And this brings us to a really profound philosophical point mentioned in the RAFT program. The phenomenologist Merleau-Ponty argued that our lived, embodied experience is the absolute fundamental ground of all our perception.
And what does that mean in practical terms?
It means that direct, felt experience in the body is the ultimate truth teller.
I love that idea. The body is a truth teller. Because if you think about it, the mind is a brilliant, manipulative lawyer.
Oh, it is the best lawyer.
It can rationalize absolutely anything. Mm-hmm. When you are tempted by a bad habit, the mind steps in and says, oh, just one more time. You deserve it. You've had a hard week. It won't matter. You can start fresh tomorrow.
Yep. We've all heard that voice.
The mind lies to us constantly to get what it wants. But the body has no capacity for deception.
The body doesn't lie. The mind can construct an endless maze of rationalizations, but the body is always standing right there at the center of the maze, holding the absolute truth of the present moment.
Wow.
If you drop the anchor and actually tune into the body, you feel the exhaustion you've been ignoring. You feel the anxiety vibrating in your chest. You feel the hollow, sinking feeling in your stomach. The body tells you the absolute, unvarnished truth about what those patterns of escape are actually doing to your nervous system.
It's the only reliable place to drop your anchor because it is the only home we truly have in this life. And learning to inhabit it, not to run from it, not to numb it with distractions, but to truly inhabit it with compassion, that is where the real work of freedom happens.
Absolutely. It is the foundation for everything else.
Now, before we bring this to a close, we want to make sure you know exactly where to find all this incredible material so you can explore it for yourself. The insights we've unpacked today come directly from the RAFT program, specifically a workbook written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And what's truly amazing is that they are making the entire 66-chapter program freely available online.
Yeah, completely free. You can find all of it and explore the rest of the framework in depth by going to their website at raft2freedom.org.
It really is a tremendous resource. And as we bring this deep dive to a close, we want to offer you a moment to put this anchor into practice right now.
I love this.
Wherever you are, I invite you to take just a few seconds to gently check in with your physical body. Don't try to change your posture, don't try to fix anything, and don't judge what you find. Just feel the physical points of contact between you and whatever is supporting you. Notice the temperature of the air on your skin. Notice any areas of tightness or any areas of ease. And as you sit there observing these sensations, ask yourself, when you think of your body as the only home you truly have in this life, how well do you feel you currently inhabit it?
It's a question worth carrying with you into the rest of your day. To leave you with a final thought on this, there is a beautiful quote at the end of the chapter by the meditation teacher Gil Fronsdal. He says, "Now, one of the marvelous things about the body is that it is always in the present moment. Our thoughts and our mind might be somewhere else, but the body is always here and now."
That is such a powerful reminder.
It really is.
So we'll leave you with this to ponder. What if the next time you feel a surge of stress or that rip current of an overwhelming compulsion tries to pull you out to sea, what if you viewed your body's physical tension not as a problem to solve and not as something you desperately need to numb? What if instead you viewed that tension as a trustworthy companion, sounding an early alarm just to keep you safe, reminding you exactly where to drop your anchor?